Hello and welcome to the American Compass podcast. My name is Oren Cass. I'm director here at American Compass. And today we are delighted to be joined by Mr. Johnny Burtka, president of the Intercollegiate Studies Institute. Johnny, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on, Oren.
No, of course. Love talking with you both off the record and on, and especially have a good topic today. You have your book coming out, Gateway to Statesmanship, Selections from Xenophon to Churchill. I'm obsessed almost these days with the statesmanship question. And I think I, you know, would highly recommend this book to folks, partly because it is such an interesting survey of what people have had to say about this for about 3,000 years. But also it's just a fun read, and you can jump around and just a lot in there. Why on earth did you write and edit and publish this?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's really a couple reasons. The first one is that if you look at our culture today, you know, everyone has heard of Jim Collins' book, Good to Great, or Peter Thiel's Zero to One. There are a million books out there that are really conduct manuals offering lifestyle advice for entrepreneurs and how to become the next Steve Jobs. But despite that, you know, we complain about our political leaders incessantly, and there's not a single comparable book for someone who wants to be a statesman or is currently a statesman. And I'm here to remind people that this is a historic anomaly of epic proportions, that there's actually this very old and venerable tradition that existed going all the way back to antiquity in every civilization, China, India, Greece, Rome, all the way up to the Renaissance, offering practical advice for statesmen that can be applied in their life. So I saw the void, and I set out to fill that.
Yeah, and I guess you use the term mirrors on princes. Is this idea of what used to be a whole genre that sort of, you know, scholars, philosophers, etc., would sort of write advice to princes, kings, leaders of whatever flavor. It's really interesting. You try to include some from the modern period, but there are no wise people writing anymore. At that point, it just has to be the leaders sort of talking themselves. What happened? Are we out of wise people? Is no one listening to them anyway? Why do you think we have to go back and read Xenophon if we want to know?
Well, you know, in the olden times, like, a lot of the people that actually wrote these books ended up getting killed in rather brutal ways by the leaders they were trying to advise. I think of Cicero. I think of Thomas More. It's a good question. I think there are really three reasons why we don't have the genre today. One is, you know, the historic shift from monarchy to representative government. It was easier, you know, when you knew who the next king or queen was going to be, to write a book and offer your services. But there's no reason that we couldn't have the same tradition for senators or for presidents or governors today. The second two kind of get more to the heart of your question about, you know, understanding statesmanship. You know, at the beginning of the Progressive Era, there was, I think, a growing discomfort with the idea of the statesman as someone, you know, a wise individual who has their hand on the rudder of the ship of state. They're navigating it through troubling waters and unpredictable winds. And there was an attempt to make leadership, to make statesmanship more scientific. And so you see the rise of management, of expertise, and more bureaucratic forms of government, really centralized in Washington, D.C. And then lastly, the higher education system stopped teaching really anything old. They're guilty of what C.S. Lewis calls presentism, which is that if it's not written in the last 10 minutes, it's either, you know, not worth knowing about or stained with some guilt of, you know, past sins. And so I think these three things combined for a perfect storm. And today, you know, I do marvel at why on earth do we have so many books for entrepreneurs and business people, but nothing comparable for statesmen. So I don't think it's for a lack of smart or wise people. I just think for whatever reason, we haven't set out to do it.
Yeah. I mean, I guess if we could analyze it as a market failure, or, I mean, in a world where book writing is a question of who's going to buy the book, there are millions of people who think they would benefit from Ray Dalio's principles, notwithstanding how many of them would actually benefit from Ray Dalio's principles, whereas the number who need to think about how to be a statesman is obviously much lower. And when those people don't happen to, you know, be kings with bags of gold, I guess it is a maybe less appealing pitch to the publisher. And yet, you know, I think as you note, it strikes me that certainly something has been lost. I mean, the model, you know, it, to some extent we stopped writing these things, but it's also that even if you wrote the best one ever, in fact, the experts would say this is not what you're supposed to be doing. What you need to be studying is cost-benefit analysis so that you can, you know, craft your EPA regulations especially well, right? I mean, we do still have a Kennedy School at Harvard, but that's what they spend all the time doing. I don't know. It strikes me as a huge problem. And, you know, obviously a book like this is a huge step as a resource, but more from the cultural side, what do you think about kind of creating a better elite? I mean, how do we actually persuade the elite that these are, you know, that there is a statesmanship to contemplate beyond EPA regulations and trade deals?
Well, that's a great question. The interesting thing is that there's no shortage of podcasts, of YouTubers who are focused on offering practical lifestyle advice, right? Whether it's, you know, I don't know, whether it's relating to dieting or physical fitness or succeeding in your career or meditating, whatever it is, right? There's a whole industry, and some of this is maybe considered to be more right wing. You think of a Jordan Peterson, you know, wake up in the morning, make your bed. But I think it goes beyond just, you know, a right wing audience. I think there's a large appetite for people, I think largely outside of the traditional institutions of power, that are just online. They've developed their own following. They're on Instagram, they're on TikTok, and they're telling people how to live because they don't really have the traditional friendships and mentor relationships that would have been the hallmark of more traditional societies. So, you know, how to get the elites to pay attention is a tough question. But, you know, to some extent, that was also a challenge with this genre as a whole. If someone's going to be a king or a queen, why should they listen to some nobody who wants to tell them how they should live or behave, who they're not accountable to? And so that was always part of the art of writing these letters. And so I think really what the tradition does is it connects these first principles, courage, prudence, power, to very practical pieces of advice that are actually in the self-interest of the leaders to implement. So you can not only become a better person, but you can also, you know, use this advice to win, right? And to keep your political opponents at bay. So I think you have to tie it to self-interest, and you also have to make it very practical.
Yeah. And is that, because I was thinking, okay, we, you know, we've got all these great pieces, but they're from, you know, 2000 years ago, let's say. If you could persuade today's senators, presidential candidates to sit down and think about and read this stuff, to what extent do you think some combination of what's in this book, or, you know, maybe you have some favorites in it, are like, here, this is actually exactly what we need today, versus to what extent do we, like, the challenges of governing today are different and we need people to think about it anew?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an interesting question, because a lot of what these texts are getting at are really foundational realities. If you're a human being and you're dealing with other human beings, this advice is going to be relevant and it'll be intelligible. You might have to appropriate it a bit for your own context, but it's sort of a study of human nature and leadership that stands the test of time. That being said, you know, a big part of bringing these texts to the fore, and including ones that are, you know, frankly, no one is, you know, Han Fei in ancient China, Cotillia in India, Agapitus in Byzantium, was really an attempt to fix one, a problem, which is, I think, you know, and this is something that American Compass is doing a good job of, getting people to think about economics in a new way, getting them to think outside the bounds of sort of the stale platitudes of the dominant modes of thinking and on right and left. And to the extent that you're doing that in economics, this book does that for politics by, you know, dusting off old thinkers and presenting new ways of thinking of of issues. One in particular that's a more modern text that I included, which I think would actually be a good exercise for many political leaders, is imitating what Charles de Gaulle did in his book, The Edge of the Sword. This is something he wrote in his early 30s. He had not accomplished anything at that point. He was a prisoner of war during World War I. But during that time, he basically smoked cigarettes all day and read old books, right? It wasn't too difficult of a life. But he sat down afterwards and he sketched out in a very short book the qualities of an ideal leader. He wrote his own Mirrors for Princes. And then he devoted the rest of his life to becoming the leader that he described on those pages. That's a very ambitious task. But I think, you know, if our leaders actually took a day, a weekend to kind of step back and just articulate, you know, what kind of man or woman do I want to be? What does public leadership look like in an ideal form? And how can I surround myself with people who can help me get to that level? I think that would help people, you know, leaders in particular, look beyond the more pressing, urgent concerns of day-to-day political life.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I think your point about the, you know, the kind of the economics and the politics, to me, they're actually very closely linked. And you know, one of the arguments that we make at American Compass a lot is that part of the problem with the sort of market fundamentalist economics is that it turns out to be a claim about politics, and that you sort of don't need politics, you don't need a common good, you just need maximizing consumption. And that, you know, one thing I think comes through looking back at these pieces, for instance, is that there was, of course, a realization that of course economics is politics, and that a core feature of ruling effectively and governing both successfully for yourself and for the people is having a conception of what you're actually trying to do, and that you know, that obviously extends far beyond just everybody being materially rich. Do you have any favorites or that you feel like sort of really speak to the way we need to kind of have a more holistic politics than the Davos elite have in mind?
Yeah, I mean, I think the amusing thing is that it would be laughable to any of these great statesmen to think that economics is somehow divorced from politics, that it's just this separate sphere that kind of runs on its own. I mean, even like Winston Churchill, if you think of the founding of or the acquisition of, you know, British Petroleum, BP, sort of that whole genesis of that was birthed, you know, in part because Churchill realized that the Allies needed their own supply of oil that they controlled that couldn't be taken into the hands of an enemy, right? And so it was, you know, how do we get the resources needed to meet our national security objectives? And so you see all throughout, you know, this tradition, you know, a few different things. You see, you know, definitely, you know, careful thinking about how does economics serve, you know, not only the common good, but also building up sort of national power and independence in a way that can keep the regime safe and secure and stable. But you also see one tension that really stands out to me I'm curious what you would actually make of it. You see this in Cicero and Erasmus is two warnings, right? On one hand, you see a warning about excessive taxation, right? You tax people too much, you're going to smother the economy, people are going to get angry, they're going to revolt. Machiavelli even famously says, you know, people will be more forgiving if you kill their father than if you take their land, right? Mm-hmm. So there's this insistence on don't have taxes be too high. At the same time, you see frequent warnings against income inequality. And most of those warnings, you could kind of parse out whether there's a justice argument against income inequality in these particular cases. But really, they're just thinking about it from a political perspective. Income inequality at great scale introduces a lot of instability into the regime. And as a leader, especially in these ancient periods, you know, order and stability was even a precondition for justice. And so, you know, that's if you have a lot of income inequality, these are, you know, warning lights flashing on the dashboard for a statesman. So I'm curious what you make of, you know, how do you, I don't know if balance is the right word, but how do you hold in tension this, the taxation with the income inequality?
No, it's a great point. And the, you know, the taxation piece of it, I think this is one of the ones where the sort of historical context is quite relevant. My sense is that the problem for a lot of kings and princes was that they were inclined to sort of confiscatory, whatever the word is, taxation. That is, the question was not sort of, should we have a social insurance program that sure. provides for everybody in this or that way? It was like, how much should we take for the people to build palaces and fund wars? And so on one hand, there's sort of obviously an underlying insight that people don't like any kind of taxation, right? All things equal, people would prefer to keep their stuff. I think that is a fine universal principle. But it does also seem to me that there's a pretty important distinction between the sort of, you know, libertarian with the taxation equals theft t-shirt, which in the context of like a French nobleman, you know, like collecting from the serfs to pursue whatever vanity project, like, might be true in a way that saying like, hey, we should probably have social security, just isn't. And so I think, you know, it's something we're very interested in American Compass, and we're actually doing some work on right now, is this exact question of, you know, how do people understand taxation in different contexts? Because obviously, all things equal, everyone, probably both of us included, would prefer lower taxes. But there are also things that we do want the government to do and would probably be happy to pay for if we thought the government was actually going sure. to do them. And so I see that in the kind of ancient context more as a warning to not just take. But I think the income inequality one, I'm glad you mentioned, because that's something that has perplexed me, I mean, really for a decade now, since I started, you know, doing work in conservative policy. Anti-poverty policy was one of the first things, probably the first thing I really did a lot of work on. And I never understood why people coded concern for income inequality as a progressive mm-hmm. thing. I understand why certain types of redistribution might be coded as progressive sure. or the sort of, you know, pre-welfare reform, sort of, you know, great society welfare state is progressive. But the idea that concern about inequality, like, well, that's not conservative, seems bizarre to me. Conservatives, I would expect, should be most concerned, given that they are much more attendant to the health of the social fabric, the, as you were saying, the order and stability as a prerequisite for justice. And so that I would just love, you know, if it takes bringing back the ancients to make the case, that's fine with me. But it seems obvious to me that having a society in which people, you know, people aren't jealous that someone might have more money than them, but in which everyone can participate as equals in the public square in the society, that should be a non-negotiable, I would think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think maybe they, you know, they jump to, okay, this means that, you know, the government has to enforce equality of outcomes, you know, in the economic sphere. But yeah, at the most fundamental level, you know, again, studying great leaders, you can never be a great leader if you don't have an intense concern and care for the poor and those who are suffering, right? It's, I mean, if you're merely aligned with the elites, you know, something's going to be wrong with your regime. So, yeah, it is curious that conservatives, especially in light of the Christian background of many conservatives or the Judeo-Christian background, seem to ignore that point.
Yeah, well, and you know, also going to the kind of progressive versus conservative coding, I think it's important to say also, and this comes through in sort of what does statesmanship and good leadership look like, that you don't remedy the problem by just taxing some and giving to others, that in its own respect sort of fosters resentment on both sides, and that what you are aspiring to is the context in which people actually can build their own decent lives. Mm-hmm. I mean, that strikes me more as the goal. And this was, we should talk about the Thomas Aquinas on this. You know, I thought I got into some very kind of modern themes of relevance to today's debates. Did that strike, I assume that struck you as well?
It did. Yeah. One of the things that made me smile, you know, having written a piece for you where I'm tracing, you know, the American history of economic nationalism and the vital role that played in the formation of our own kind of country's economic system. I'm always on the hunt for these examples of where that thread can be tied in more ancient sources. So it was quite peculiar for me to be reading, you know, Aquinas's On Kingship here and going through a, you know, sort of a very, you know, philosophic treatise on the nature of good governance and faith. And then at the very end, in sort of chapter two, just almost stuck at the back of the book, here you have Aquinas, the protectionist and the skeptic of immigration. And I'm thinking, holy cow, this is straight out of an American Compass newsletter. And basically for Aquinas, it's not a particularly long section, but he's talking about how, you know, a healthy city is one that is relatively independent in its economic resources. And the more that a city is dependent on trade for the essentials of life, the weaker it is, you know, and it's weaker for, you know, the simple reason that if something disrupts that trade, you no longer have those resources that you need. But also, and this kind of gets to the immigration point, for him, it highly sort of a globalized systems, you're bringing in, you know, people that don't necessarily share your customs or your values and who are in pursuit of money, you know, and who are often greedy. And there's a risk. It's not saying that everyone who's a merchant is intrinsically bad if they come from another culture, but he says there's at least a risk there that their values will be different than your own values, and that'll undermine kind of the cultural foundations of that particular city. And then he concludes with this warning on merchants. And this is something that is all throughout the tradition, is this really a very skeptical view of merchants, you know, and I'm moved by great entrepreneurs just as much as the next American, but it is interesting to see in this tradition the skepticism of the merchant class, mostly for Aquinas, because he's worried that their interest won't always be on the common good or even on the sort of the ultimate goods of God and proper religion, but on just purely material gain at any cost. And he's worried that could actually corrode the nature of the city.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's a great segue. I wanted to sort of bring all this into the current context now as we head into the 2024 election cycle. And that point about sort of the health of the city and what it actually looks like to have a healthy kind of polity and all the ways that has nothing to do with sort of, you know, how the stock market did last quarter, strikes me as something that we are just very obviously missing right now, especially in the more sort of elite discourse and effort to make sense of what is going on politically in America. I mean, you have these two candidates in Biden and Trump, I would say at least probably neither of which reflects well too many of the important principles of statesmanship in the books. And yet the analysts looking at the situation seem to just want to try to understand things through this very narrow sort of economistic lens. Mm-hmm. And they get very frustrated when that's not how the rest of the country seems to assess things. And, you know, one thing that made me think is it's not even so much like Trump and Biden need to read this stuff, but it's more like the chattering class really, really sort of needs to read this stuff and understand in a different way what's going on in our politics. Are there particular themes that whether they're in the book or not, like that you would emphasize? How have we gotten so wrong and created so much of a disconnect between how we formally assess the health of the nation and how the people in the nation actually seem to mm-hmm. feel about it?
Yeah, I think part of it is because the chattering class, as you described it, is so disconnected in their everyday social and professional lives with reality. I mean, America is at a pretty existential point right now. The main issues that are you know, threatening the American regime, they're actually not particularly complicated, right? We're sort of on life support right now, and there's very fundamental things that you could do that if any leader just kind of picked up the ball and did these things, they would be lauded as a national hero. They'd probably usher in a whole new era of political leadership, right? And I mean, it's we know them as much as we can, you know, we've identified a lot of these, but it's basic law and order, right? You have to have safe cities, like safety. This is throughout the Mirrors for Princes tradition. This is a prerequisite of any healthy regime. People need to be safe, right? This basic security, like securing the southern border, not just having a system where you that's totally disorganized, that doesn't serve the economic or the cultural interests of a people, right? So, all right, clean up the cities, secure the southern border. Abroad, you know, I think it's America's leadership is being tested in multiple theaters around the world at a time when our basic, you know, infrastructure, health, education is crumbling, you know, so take care of your own people. There has to be some priority to, if you can't take care of your own people, how can you be helping people all throughout the world? I mean, the list could go on. You go to education and it's, you know, restore excellence to our education system. You know, there's an aspect of this that deals with the woke issue, which I think can simply be remedied by just don't teach crazy stuff. You know, it's people want that return towards normalcy. But also there's a lot and something that American Compass has been focused on, which is the importance of vocational training and just how outdated our system of particularly college education is today. I was just hearing about a local trade school that's, you know, about a half hour from ISI. It's fully funded. It's for high school graduates. It's a 3-year program. And everyone graduating from this school is getting 6-figure job offers. And it's all 100% paid for. You know, there are so many other, these are just kind of basic kind of well-being, economic. I mean, these are kind of basic principles that should just be common sense to anyone. And I think this is why your average American is so fed up and is so hurting. And I think any leader who can actually come in and start addressing them is going to really be a big change agent. But for some reason, the chattering classes just don't see these problems. I mean, the other thing I think is it's just amusing to me at how it's like every day the New York Times publishes a story about how, you know, it's so confusing, you know, like the economy is doing great. Stock market is off the charts, but people are deluded and they just feel like the economy is bad. And it's really because, you know, I don't know, they're stupid or they're out of touch with reality, you know? And it's like, well, if everyone feels like the economy is in the tank, you know, something fundamental is wrong that we're overlooking. So instead of getting curious, they look down their noses.
Yeah, it's funny. We released some really interesting survey data at American Compass looking at just attitudes toward Biden policies on the economy. Because it is, you know, look, is it the best economy ever? I mean, you can rate it however you want. There are problems, there are bright spots, but people are so negative on it. Like you would think we were in the middle of a deep recession. Mm-hmm. And like you said, everyone, you know, the New York Times has to run another piece every day on sort of, you know, what's wrong with people? Why are they believing their lying eyes over what our data tell them? And so what we found that was so interesting is that, you know, the actual kind of issues that the Biden White House or the Democratic Party broadly have sort of chosen to pick fights on are these issues, basically in a lot of the ways, the ones that you just rattled off, things like immigration, you know, the student loan forgiveness, climate policy is obviously a big one. These things where most people just don't agree, mm-hmm. like, and not just the Republicans, but the independents don't agree, or, you know, sure. Relatively speaking, the upper class is much more enthusiastic. The working class is much less enthusiastic. And so we sort of said, you know, look, this provides, I think, some good color on why, if you're asking people how they feel about Biden on the economy, they're looking at the things that are actually Biden, that you're getting from Biden, that you would get different from someone else. And they're saying, like, well, these things don't help us and we don't like them. And Aaron Dubé, who's a professor at University of Massachusetts, I think he's, you know, very progressive. I think he actually does a lot of very good work on things like the minimum wage. But he just jumped on Twitter to respond actually Biden's policies are great for the working class, with a chart of wage growth over the last 4 years, showing that it had been higher for working class folks than upper class folks. And it was just like, no one's denying the data in that chart. But the question is, if you have that data and yet that is clearly not sufficient, that has happened in the world and that has not clearly produced the satisfaction support you expected, what do you do with that? Shouldn't that perplex you? And it just doesn't seem to. And I worry that is sort of leading us toward a situation where the elite just sort of disowns its obligation to actually govern on behalf of the people. And that was one way the book really resonated with me, is like, at the end of the day, it is really hard to persuade the elite they have to care about the people. Mm-hmm. And today they don't seem to.
And I think this is another thing that ties into the book, which is, you know, great leaders are storytellers, right? They paint beautiful pictures of the world that they want people to inhabit, and they give them the confidence that they're bringing that about. They're not leading with logic or with rational arguments. They're appealing to the heart, to the imagination. They're often builders of beautiful things. And, you know, I think with the data you just mentioned, you know, it's one of these things where, you know, you could argue, even if you set aside whether you would agree or disagree with the climate agenda of Biden or the infrastructure agenda, you could say, all right, those investments he's making, he's perceiving those as kind of long-term investments, right? He makes these, you might not see the results right away, but maybe in 10 years, you know, maybe it'll be a cleaner environment, maybe we'll have better infrastructure. So I think part of it is, okay, the Biden folks are saying, look, we're making these long-term economic investments that are going to pay off, right? That we have your best interest at heart. But, you know, I was just at the Wilmington train station the other day, and when I went to the convenience store to look for something for breakfast, the little hummus cup with about 2 ounces of hummus was $6. I kid you not, it was $6. And I laughed at it. You know, I thought, what? You know, like, that's absurd. You know, and I went and bought a banana instead. But it's the sticker shock, you know. I'm never going to pay $6 for a cup of hummus. You know, I have other friends that are, you know, recently out of college that are living in this area, you know, suburban kind of Philadelphia, Wilmington. They're looking for apartments. The only apartments they can find are $2,200, you know, because the cost of rent is so high everywhere. And so it's like, all right, well, if you're someone's only making $35,000 a year and you're expecting them to pay for a $2,200 apartment and buy a $6 hummus snack at the train station, they're going to feel like things are bad no matter how many graphs you show them.
Yeah. Well, so I want to talk about aristopopulism. Tell the listeners what that is.
Yeah, so aristopopulism, it's something that I've been thinking about and writing about going back 4 or 5 years now. But really, its main focus is, well, two things. One, it's understanding that great leaders throughout history have almost always had a deep connection with everyday people and a contempt for aristocrats and elites. Often we, you know, like to think when we look back at history, oh, you know, the kings and the queens, like, they're just off with the aristocrats doing their thing and the people are kind of suffering. And maybe that's the case in certain regimes. But largely, you know, the most popular and successful kings and queens had this deep connection with the people, and they were really fighting the elites tooth and nail. And so first and foremost, it's kind of a reminder, aristopopulism, that if you're going to be a successful political leader, you actually have to have that connection to common everyday people. The second aspect of it is, you know, making the case that we actually need to, you know, populism alone is not enough, right? You're always going to have elites of some type. It's just a question of whether they're going to be good or bad, whether they have self-interest or the common good at heart. And so there actually has to be a way in which we realign the incentives in our country so that the interest of the elites is actually aligned with the people. And I think this is, you know, an issue that connects to free trade and other forms of the financialized economy. the economic incentives, you know, for someone like Henry Ford creating Model Ts is much different than today. You know, then he was creating something that had a clear, tangible benefit for all of his workers who could actually afford to buy the product. Today, you know, the first thing that many companies would think to do is, all right, how do we outsource as many of our, how do we outsource production? How do we import cheap labor and strip mine sort of the heart of America? And so I think we need to think about how do we realign the economic incentives and other incentives for elites so it actually serves the interest of the people. So that's the vision behind Aristopopulism.
Yeah, the Henry Ford example is fascinating because you can contrast it so directly with Elon Musk. I mean, if you think about the electric vehicle as sort of the first, you know, true revolution in that industry since the Model T in some respects, likewise developed here, actually subsidized quite aggressively. But what's happened? He moved production to China as quickly as possible. He's pledged to uphold core socialist values there. He was just quoted saying, you know, that they'll look into licensing their autonomous vehicle technology and so forth to Chinese competitors. And he's certainly doing quite well for himself in that formula. But it does not have the broader, the spillover benefits, as the economists say, that Ford did in the day. I think you're exactly right. This is obviously something we focus on a lot at Compass, is this idea of sort of like, okay, what are those kind of table stakes constraints, right? Because like, you're not going to solve this with 5,000 page pieces of legislation or, you know, some new different better administrative state. It really is one of those broader conceptual constraints. Like, no, you actually have to pursue your interests and your profit with the people who are here at the end of the day. That's that sort of mutual dependence seems to be the non-negotiable element that we really kind of gave up in recent decades. Are there other things that come to mind for you besides, you know, trade, the sort of trade and immigration speak to this idea of, look, this, you know, there is something about the national market that's important. I think you probably better than anyone are positioned to think about what this means in the educational context. What would it mean for our institutions of higher education to actually be producing elites that could be good elites?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think two other areas besides the trade and immigration are really, you know, education, and then maybe the second one is the military-industrial complex and how that relates to innovation and our industrial capacity. On education, it really is tough. I mean, because we're, you know, ISI is working on and off, you know, over 150 college campuses across the country. And, you know, I have come to the conclusion that I don't think that higher education as it stands is redeemable. I don't think it can be saved. I think it needs to be destroyed, right? And by and large, and something new needs to come to the fore. And, you know, I think that something new will include building new institutions of higher learning. And I think there's a way in which, hopefully through the destruction of the current system, we can actually redirect, because oftentimes you can't just destroy something, right? It's I like to think of it, these are mighty rivers. It's like, you know, Niagara Falls, it's flowing in a direction. You just don't dam Niagara Falls. It's impossible, right? So we often have to, I think, redirect the river towards more productive ends than where it's currently flowing. And so, you know, is there a way that you can redirect the resources that we're spending at the national level and even at the state level in education towards vocational schools, towards new modes of thinking about higher education? So that, you know, that's a tough problem, but I do think we need radical change in the education space. You know, with the military industrial complex, you know, I do think it was interesting if you even think of sort of the Trump presidency, you know, for all the things that he said, which drew the ire of the various elite classes. I think whenever he would try to get us out of a conflict, you know, you had the generals, both that were his own advisors or the people in the Pentagon, that would really, really revolt. The harshest criticism of him from the elites actually came when he tried to sort of rein in or scale back the military adventurism, which just tells me, you know, how powerful the grip of sort of Boeing and Raytheon and Lockheed is on our political apparatus. You know, so much so that you're probably never going to be able to totally, you know, break them up or whatnot. So I think you actually have to think about, is there a way that you can actually get these companies, get the military industrial complex working towards our national interests instead of just their own self-interests? So I don't know, as we talked about America's crumbling infrastructure and sort of the lack of, you know, national capacity, you know, maybe there's a way that you could actually put them to work, actually rebuilding America's industrial base. Maybe that incentive would be strong enough that they can move away from, you know, building the equipment to fight yesterday's wars to actually be invested in new technologies that would give us a competitive edge. So I'm all about trying to figure out, how do we harness these failing but powerful, you know, sectors for more productive ends than what we have now? And if we can't destroy them, then I think redirecting them is the next best thing.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I've never thought about the military industrial complex in that context. It brings to mind for me two things. One is, you know, Sam Hammond, friend of the pod, as they say, always talks about the idea that, you know, any country is going to have an industrial policy. You know, it is just a question of what industrial policy, and you are always going to have special interests steering it. So mm-hmm. the art is not in, you know, draining the swamp or keeping the special interests out. It's in picking the right special interests and having them, you know, push toward things that might actually be useful. And so, yeah, I guess we could build fewer bombs and more bridges, or sounds like a hippie slogan, but might work. The other thing it brings to mind for me that I've been interested in for a while is nuclear power as sort of the mm-hmm. kind of quintessential technology that, you know, it's not the kind of moonshot where you just have to dream of something out there that doesn't exist. It's like, we could build, pick your number, 10, 50, 100 nuclear power plants and have, you know, for free or extremely cheap, plentiful, environmentally friendly energy for America. That would in turn give us incredible advantages in manufacturing and other parts of the economy. And yeah, it's actually, it's a lot of the same people who are lobbying to be paid to build other things. If you could just sort of say, hey, why don't you lobby us to pay you to build these useful things instead? Like maybe they'd be okay with that. That's that could work out better for everybody. That's really interesting. Well, thank you very much for spending some time with us here on the American Compass podcast. The book is Gateway to Statesmanship, Selections from Xenophon to Churchill. Buy it, put it on your bedside table, pick a great former advisor to princes to read each night before bed, and we will soon have a more virtuous elite, I suppose.
I hope so. That's the hope. That's the plan. Thanks for having me, Warren.
Of course. Thanks for doing this. This has been the American Compass podcast. Thank you for listening, and we will be back again soon with much more to talk about.